The following programming is sponsored by
MBC Media.
The views expressed do not necessarily reflect this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And an eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here. When you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining down.
Good afternoon, Philadelphia, and welcome back to the Conservative Voice on WWDB AM 860. I am Gary Heasley, your host, here with Ada Nestor, who's in the studio with me, a co-host. Hey, Ada, how are you today?
I'm great. Excited. We're in September now, only a couple months till the election to go.
Oh, yeah. We're getting close. And you can feel the tension building out there, can't you?
Yeah.
So we're going to have an interesting discussion today. We have with us, joining us around 12:30, Dr. Peter McCullough. Dr. McCullough, many of you know, is someone that's been deeply involved in the discussions around the COVID infection, the vaccines that came after, and it's been spending more time lately talking about what we can do now to make sure people stay healthy. So I think this is going to be an interesting conversation where we may kind of walk through the whole of what happened, where are we now, where are we going from here. So I hope that you stay with us until 12:30 and listen to that. Now, we're going to run that conversation from about 12:30 to about 1:30. And then from 1:30 to 2, we'd really like to get your questions. So if you have questions that you'd like to ask, you can do that by joining the conversation. And to do that, you dial 888-329-3306. Again, to join the conversation, dial 888-329-3306. And if you have questions, we're going to make sure to make time to get to them in that 1:30 to 2 o'clock hour. And of course, call anytime if you got a question, and we'll try to break and bring you in. But it's important to us to kind of hear what you're thinking. And, you know, we're all in a different place with this whole analysis of the history we've been through these last 4 years with this virus and the vaccines and the boosters and the stuff. I think this would be a good time for us to have those discussions. So please call us now. Before we get there, of course, Aida and I are going to talk a little bit about what's going on today, and it's interesting. I was at a town hall 2 days ago in Philadelphia. I was at an event for a candidate down here for Congress, Aaron Beshear.
Yeah.
Now, Aaron's run for a bunch of different positions, and his background, he's got experience in finance, and he's got a lot of experience that he could bring to bear in any number of different government roles. But what I like about this is that he's always in the fight. He's always leaning into it. And, right. You know, he laid out at this town hall we did what his primary interests are. And you know, what I wanted to get out of this was really gauging what people care about. And it's interesting because it's, you know, it's different things in different places. One of the things we talked about a lot the other night was, of course, the fentanyl crisis, which hits Philadelphia pretty hard. And, you know, many of you have heard me use these numbers all the time. But if you look at the number of deaths in Pennsylvania, right, it's 14 people every day die from a Chinese Communist Party chemical weapon that goes into the cartels. The cartels move it across the border that our government allows them to control.
Yeah.
And then they distribute it coast to coast, river to lakes. And so far, since the Democrats seized power, they have they've killed 400,000 people
with this
weapon.
Poisoned.
It's a poison.
I mean, it's not, we're not looking at the crack epidemic. We're not looking at heroin here. We are looking at something that just one use can kill you. And when you have kids taking pills from their friends, I mean, thinking they come out of their parents' medicine cabinet and they're pressed with fentanyl. One pill, you go to sleep and you don't wake up. So those are poisonings.
Right.
I tell my kids constantly the dangers of taking drugs from anyone. And it has to be even more, I think, today than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago with us, because there wasn't, I don't think, anything other than heroin at a larger dose that could kill you the way fentanyl can kill you.
No, there's never been anything on the street that I'm aware of like fentanyl.
Right.
And now you've got xylazine and other things.
400,000
dead Americans. And what gets me is it's not a scandal, right?
No one's screaming about it.
No one's screaming.
Nobody's
marching in the streets. But what I did gather at the town hall here in Philadelphia on Wednesday night, is that there's a growing sense amongst the people of Philadelphia, and I hope it's the same in Chicago and Baltimore, where they're saying, you know, we've been under the harness of this Democrat machine, which really is just a political machine. It doesn't much care about the people. Anybody that drives through the city knows they don't care about the infrastructure. The roads are a mess. There's a ton of money, though.
There's a ton of money going to these problems.
It's unbelievable, but if you lease a car in Philadelphia, you pay an 11% sales tax on your lease payments. Wow. 11%?
Yeah.
See, there's just never enough money for government, and they have huge amounts of money flowing into Philadelphia, including the soda tax, you may remember, from a couple of years ago. Of course, that was going to help the kids. Are the kids healthier now?
No.
Are they better educated?
No,
it turns out they're not. So what I gathered from the group we were speaking with the other night, and there were some brilliant people there, it was really fun, was that there's a growing sense of discontent. People that are starting to say, wait a minute. We see the bodies piling up. We see the education failure.
Yeah.
We see the taxes draining us of our hard-earned cash. We see this sort of assault on our people and no relief in sight. We've been supporting the same corrupt machine for decades and decades and decades. Maybe, just maybe, it's time to change.
Try something different.
Give it a shot.
I mean, what do you have to lose at this point? Have we not seen enough?
It's a good question. What do you have to lose? And then you could say, well, wait a minute. Maybe some of these things are just happening because of government incompetence. No. What we have at our border is not a crisis. What we have at our border is a strategy being executed to perfection.
Perfection.
You cannot have hundreds of thousands of children trafficked across that border.
What is it? 320,000 missing children that have come over the border that are just gone. They can't find them.
They're gone. And you can't have that happen year after year after year with no response. You can't have the federal government flying illegal aliens all over the country and even going to foreign countries to find people to come here and flying them in,
yeah,
and then turn around and call it incompetence.
Mm-hmm.
This is not incompetence.
There was a really good, maybe I should have grabbed it. There was a really good interview with, I think it was Welker is her name maybe, with J.D. Vance. And she tried to say the numbers coming across the southern border had reduced, that they've dropped. And he very quickly responds with, because they're flying them in now.
Right.
They're flying them directly to these cities and towns and bringing it to you. Last week we talked about Aragua.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a hard one.
Once you get it, you get it.
But so TDA, is as they're being called, was just in Aurora in Colorado. And since then, we've seen incidents in Chicago, Illinois. And then I just read a notice that was put out to the people working in the oil fields in Texas. They're there in Texas. And they're raiding the oil field for whatever they can rob from the workers or the facilities themselves. So it is spreading. How is it spreading? Well, because they're flying them directly to your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And anybody that thought that somehow this truly was just struggling families trying to find freedom from oppression, I mean, that's quite silly. Anyone who thought that when these huge numbers, millions and millions and millions of illegal aliens entered the country, the gangs who brought them here, the gangs who bring the fentanyl, who deliver the children, they weren't coming as well.
Yeah.
You know, a year ago, no one had heard of Trent.
Yeah.
Now,
I wasn't familiar with them until the last month or two.
Well, we started talking about them on the radio maybe 3 months ago. There was an incident where they started showing up in New York and the National Guard had begun looking for tattoos of people coming off buses, tattoos that were specific to that gang. And then all of a sudden, well, they're in Chicago. And you know what happens after that? They're everywhere.
Yeah.
And of course, that's when it broke that the murder rate in Venezuela is going down because they're exporting their gangs. They're exporting
the
murders.
Here.
They're exporting their prison populations.
They're rapists.
And
their child.
The people in charge of this city and in charge of this state and in charge of this nation all support that. They all support it. There's no fight. They're not doing anything to stop it. In fact, they're telling us it has to continue. And if you listen to Chuck Schumer yesterday come out, he's saying we have to make these people citizens.
No matter how many there are. He said 10 million, whatever the number is.
They used this number, 11 million, for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. He used that number again.
Tucker Carlson has thoroughly debunked that one, by the way, back when he was still on Fox, too, not even independently.
Yeah, 11 million or how many, because he knows the number that we're talking about nationalizing, we're talking about making citizens, is over 20 million people.
And forget the dreamers. Like, let's just take away anyone who was here prior to 2021. We're talking massive numbers between 2021 and 2024 that he's talking about making legal too.
Right.
And just to keep in mind what kind of people these are people who broke laws to come here in the first place. They're all criminals by doing what they did by coming across our border in the way that they did it. We have a process. We have both a process for immigration and we have a process for asylum. So these are the people that we want to keep here in our country. These are the people that we want to hand citizenship to and the full privileges of being an American citizen and everything that comes with that, because they made it across the border and snuck into the country successfully.
Well, and they're not even sneaking now. They simply write a check to the cartels or pay cash. I'm sure they pay cash. I don't think cartels taking money orders. They pay the cartels cash, anywhere from a couple of thousand dollars up to $35,000 for a Chinese Communist Party operative, right? For a military operator they're sending in is closer to $35,000. So they're paying these people a bounty, a tariff, a fee to convey them into the country. And yeah, we're looking at 10.5 million, 10.5 million known encounters since the Democrats seized power. Those are catch and release.
Now,
a small number of those, and it is a small number, have gone back. There were some that were exported, that were sent home. It's a small number.
But I've heard someone offer to bring those back.
Well, that's a current plan. So you've got 10.5 million, you've got a little bit that went out, and then you've got these gotaways, and they're the known and unknown gotaways. The known gotaways right now are about 2 million. And those are people that the government just decided they weren't even going to try to stop. They weren't even going to chase. Just let them come in. Mm-hmm. Now you're saying we're going to go back to the people who we deported for coming here illegally with criminal backgrounds or on the and we're going to pay to bring them back in. That's the
with Kamala, an apology.
That's the with an apology. That's the Harris plan. So it is lunacy, but what it is not is incompetence. This is a plan. It's being executed to perfection, and it's not just with that. Of course, it goes through the government spending that drives inflation that's affecting every family. None of this is incompetence. This is a plan. And anyone who votes for that plan supports the destruction of the nation, because no nation—
Full stop. Full stop. I don't want to hear any more about the principled conservatives who have come out and endorsed Kamala Harris. You are not principled and you are far from a conservative if you want to endorse what we have seen these last 4 years. It will only get worse. It will not get better.
No.
She is in power right now. Look at the results. So, I think Liz Cheney came out and endorse Kamala this week. I think also, who was it? It was John McCain's son. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know he had a son. So, to give you an idea on how really politically irrelevant the kid is. But we get it. You hate Donald Trump so much that you would rather watch this country burn to the ground than just keep your mouth shut and be quiet and let it happen, that you would come out and support a Marxist, an actual Marxist who wishes for the destruction of our country.
Think about that. So this kid is this. He's not a kid. He's a man. He's wearing a uniform from the United States military, and he's advocating politically for the people who refuse to defend our border, because he's saying what, that the rest of us are traitors because we want the border defended.
Donald Trump's mean, and he hurt everyone's feelings by speaking the truth, and now they can't handle it, so they'd rather endorse full-on communism and let the country burn. I think that's the gist, right?
That's it. And then you also have, of course, Pat Toomey, the former Republican called it. He called himself a Republican back in the day, U.S. Senator, who said he will not vote for Donald Trump because apparently Pat Toomey doesn't like secure borders. He doesn't have a problem with hundreds of thousands of children being trafficked across our border and lost.
Yep.
The fake term unaccompanied minor. He doesn't have a problem with inflation that is crushing American families. No, no, no.
Peace in the Middle East. He definitely has a problem with that.
Right. And I would
guess that he has a big problem with peace in the Middle East.
He doesn't have a problem with Hillary Clinton challenging the 2016 election, with all the Democrats that have challenged elections. The woman down in Georgia that challenged that election still has refused, 7 years later, to concede her governor's race. Those aren't a problem, but it's a problem that Donald Trump said, oh, there might have been some fraud.
Which?
Now, it turns out.
There might have been some fraud.
There's a mountain of evidence that says, maybe.
Oh, but wait. I hear on the news that there is no evidence and no court has ever, said there was evidence. Is that not the case?
Well, it turns out there's plenty of evidence.
Is there?
It turns out, if you get into the questions, there's a lot of evidence. You start really looking at it. But if you choose not to look. So Pat Toomey, who's supposed to have been a conservative Republican, who never once fought for any of the issues that the Republican voter wanted, so he had to resign from his office because he knew there was no chance he'd get elected.
Yeah.
Because the Republican conservative voter had turned away from him. Now, not the brand loyal Republican that would vote for any R. And they say, I don't care who the Republican is, I'll vote for the Republican. I'm a brand loyal voter. And Democrats have those too. That's about 35% of the country on the Democrat side.
Yeah.
I don't know how many that is on the Republican side, but his problem is with the people who are actually looking at the policies he's supporting and saying, I will not vote for that man one more time. So he has to resign. Now he's formally joined the other side.
Yeah. Did he change his registration or just by endorsement?
Just by endorsement, just like some of the others.
But again, how do you endorse the insanity we've seen? How do you, as a conservative, as a Republican, endorse price controls?
Well, the reality is he doesn't care about the issues that affect people. He's a political opportunist. I'm sure he made a tremendous amount of money during his time in the Senate or since being in the Senate from what he learned and the connections he made there.
Yeah. A lot of board seats open up for you when you leave public office.
Exactly. So one of the challenges we have is this idea that many of the Republican elected officials aren't ideological. Right. They actually don't share a philosophy with the base. Toomey's clearly one of them. And
the ideologues, those of us who have a strong ideology in a conservative direction, we're the enemy to them.
Absolutely.
I have literally heard conservatives tell me that I'm an ideologue and that I am the problem. I'm a problem because I have beliefs that I stand by.
And they have no ideology.
None.
They just, it's brand loyal. Now, here's the question. For the brand loyal Republican who's just been going along with anyone, do they look at Toomey and say, wait a minute, that's a problem because he's broken with the brand? Or do they listen to the media and say, well, mean tweets, Donald Trump wants to secure the border. Donald Trump wants us to cut this fentanyl death thing. I'm against Trump.
In Southeast PA?
This is the dichotomy in their heads. This is the internal fight they have to be struggling with as they try to figure out how to support the Toomeys of the world or how to support the media imagery
of Trump. The Liz Cheneys. I think it's easy for a lot of people to think they're the principled conservatives in this stage because I do think Donald Trump's abrasiveness does turn a lot of people off. And I really wish more people would look at his abrasiveness as a weapon that is used for our benefit and not something that's being used against us. I think that, I say this all the time. I want him in every negotiation I ever have. If there was a serious negotiation, I would want Donald Trump at that table. I want him in that room. I saw the results from the first 4 years he was in office, and we prospered. We are a normal middle-class family, and we did very well through those years. And I don't mean, we're wealthy now. I mean, I didn't really worry week to week about my grocery bill. I had a little bit of a cushion there. I had savings. I paid for some of my daughter's wedding. We were able to do things that, would have been a dream 20 years ago to me. So I look at results. And I think if the media had their way and the Democrats had their way, they would keep you looking at personality and keep you looking at Trump is bad, Orange Man bad, Trump derangement syndrome. He just did an interview this week. I don't know if it was the one we discussed this week with the Economic Society or it was somewhere else, but they asked him what he would do with the second term. And he admitted that he made mistakes in the first term with staffing.
Oh yeah.
And I saw a lot of positive responses to him admitting the mistake, because I think people don't listen to him on a regular basis to understand that I think he is quite humble and he does admit when he makes mistakes. So I think it's just, if you look at the Republicans that are only getting their information from the media, in comparison to those of us who are actually just listening to the man, watching him interact with the press or with other human beings, it's very easy to think that the Toomeys and the Cheneys are the principled ones and Trump is a threat to our society.
So bringing it away from some of the more, shocking issues like trafficking hundreds of thousands of children who disappear into the night.
Do you remember AOC standing at the border at the chain link fence crying for the family separation policy, which, just a reminder for anyone real quick, the family separation policy was they were doing DNA tests at the border to find out if that child was actually related to the family bringing that child across the border. And they found out that, shockingly, many of them weren't related.
Turns out and they're not unaccompanied, they're cargo.
Yes.
So, but moving away from those more alarming issues that we talk about frequently because, you can't avoid them. They're just right in front of us every day.
Right.
Thinking about something like tax. Now, these conservatives, these principled conservatives are supporting a group that wants to take the corporate tax from where it is now, which is around 25%, up to about 30% again. Now, if they think this through, of course, you know that the corporations, when they get a tax, it's an increase in their cost. And that cost, as we've seen through this whole inflationary period, will be passed along to the consumer. So what happens when they do that is they're simultaneously making the United States a less competitive place because we become now extraordinarily high tax compared to other countries in the world. And they cause a tax-driven inflation, if you will. It's government regulation. It's the tax policy actually causing prices to go up. Yeah. It's not just excess spending. It's the regulatory regime that's also doing that. So that's what these principled conservatives like Pat Toomey want to have happen. Now, if you remember back 10 years ago, before Trump's tax changes came, companies had begun moving their headquarters overseas.
Yeah.
They'd begun leaving the United States, not just with their operations, which they've been doing for 20, 30 years. They began moving their headquarters overseas. In fact, in Cleveland, there was a company called Eaton that had been there for over 100 years. Suddenly, they moved to Ireland. Because when they looked at the state, and they operate in many states, the state tax burden, they look at the federal tax burden. They said, we simply can't compete, and it's fiscally irresponsible. We're being negligent to stay in the United States. So they did what's called a tax inversion. They moved to Ireland and shifted their corporate tax rate over there. Now, that also gave them access to capital that they'd earned in foreign countries. Now, if they brought it back to the United States, they had to pay U.S. tax on it. So they had to keep it overseas. Donald Trump's tax policies fixed all of that.
Right.
When he did the tax reform, he made it competitive, the United States, competitive against other nations. Mm-hmm. He took away the reason to do a tax conversion. Up until then, everybody was saying we have to force these corporations to stay here.
Yes.
As if somehow you can do that.
Yeah.
Because they'll either go out of business.
You're going to tax your product extra when it comes back in.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there was I remember.
They'll either go out of business, they'll spin off divisions. There's no way you can trap a corporation in an unhealthy situation. You'll kill it or it will modify and move out.
Yeah.
So he stops all that. All of a sudden, not only do we have corporations no longer taking the tax inversion and moving away, but they begin, because of the breaks, they begin bringing in the $2 trillion that they repatriated because they could do that without having the 34% tax hit that they had at the time. So it was interesting. That tax change, driven by Trump, not by anybody else, that tax change immediately resulted in reshoring of industrial capabilities, industrial facilities. That meant jobs went up and wages went up for American workers.
And manufacturing came back, which is a middle class boom for any community that manufacturing is happening in.
You know, it is, but it's also a boon to the consultants, the accountants, the lawyers who work around those industries.
Right.
Everybody wins. So now we've got this guy, Pat Toomey, who's going to the other side to support them because why? Because Donald Trump pointed out there was fraud in 2020. These people are clowns.
Wow.
And I'm hoping that the brand loyal Republican voter begins to stop and say, who are these people that I'm supporting? Maybe I need to be a little more discerning. Let me look at the guy that did the tax policy that changed the economic fate of a nation, rather than the guy that sat in Congress for 20 years while jobs went overseas, wages went down in real terms, you know, consolidation took away our choices.
Towns died.
Towns
Americans
died.
Suffered.
And all he did is sit on top and profit.
Yeah.
That's not a guy that I respect.
Yeah.
So Pat Toomey can endorse the other side. He can say he's not voting for Trump. I couldn't possibly care less. I just care about the people who may not be thinking it through thoroughly and may be influenced by someone like him.
Right.
Now, there's another topic we wanted to hit on real quick, which is this idea that, you know, we've brought in now, the Trump team has brought in the RFK move.
I know.
Right?
Wow, that was the whole headline for this half hour, and we haven't even gotten there.
Sometimes it takes a while.
Oh, goodness.
The RFK shift, bringing in Tulsi Gabbard.
Right.
These are Democrats, right?
Yeah.
Now, I spend a lot of time with people who
targeted
were Democrats.
Democrats.
That's right. I spend a lot of time with people who were Democrats 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now they have become so aware mm-hmm. that they are more conservative than the brand loyal Republican, sort of the polite conservative
right.
who will surrender to the Democrats to avoid being criticized. You know, they don't want to offend anybody. Those folks, the folks that were Democrats that have converted, that have become awake, oh, they're aggressive now. They're on our side.
I'm not real
fighters.
Worried about offending anyone anymore. If you're offended by what I say, then you should do more research. Then I'm not trying to upset anyone.
That ship sailed.
Yeah.
Eh? So when you think about the implications, and people are saying, wait a minute, you know, are we going left? Here's the thing. This is how I look at it. Interested in getting your view. When I look at RFK, I can list pages and pages of things I disagree with him with on policy.
Yep.
He has a leftist bent when it comes to the role of government, when it comes to economics, when it comes to spending. When he looks at the $2 trillion deficit money and some of it being wasted somewhere, he says, oh, we could use that somewhere else. I look at it and say, it doesn't exist.
Right.
We shouldn't be spending it at all.
It's imaginary.
We have a lot of disagreements. Yeah. But where we come together are on very important issues. He is focused on and dedicated to fighting for children's health.
Yeah.
These questions he's raising about our food supply, well, I'm looking around. I've seen the level of autism go from 1 in 1,500 to 1 in 36, maybe 1 in 32 now. I've seen people talk. We were just talking about peanut allergies before the show.
Yeah.
When we were kids, you went to Dairy Queen. Nobody worried about the peanuts.
Right.
Now there's signs everywhere, and kids have to be careful about whether they're going to get killed because they went there. There's something wrong in our system. We are somehow being poisoned. Now, when he did his speech a couple of weeks ago, he went through these in a clear and concise way.
And not a fantastic way, not a fantastical way
no.
that would turn people off who maybe haven't heard these kind of, you know, ideas or implications before.
He was specifically not hyperbolic.
Yes.
He was really just giving the facts.
Yeah.
Where we come into common cause with a guy like RFK, I'm very aligned. Yes. And I think he could be a valuable asset to the team. Tulsi Gabbard, somewhat the same. I don't want Tulsi Gabbard being involved in our economic policy. That's just not, I mean, she's a lifetime government employee until she's the last couple of years. When she was running for president, what she was saying on that front was not attractive. Now, when you talk to her about something like Syria, you remember she got in trouble with the Democrat Party because she dared challenge the narrative of a nation we were going to war in and no Americans knew why.
Yeah.
We were told that our allies were great freedom fighters. But we didn't really know anything about them, except they seemed to sound a lot like the Taliban that we were allies with before.
Right.
When we fought the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are going into this war. No one understands. She had the courage to stand up and go over there and actually sit down with Bashar al-Assad, the only leader left over there that dresses in a suit and it seems to have Western parts, and sat down with him and said, what is this about?
Right.
Now, he was demonized in the press every day. Then she was demonized in the press because she was threatening the business model of the people that make the products that get dropped on people over there. So I understand that, you know, that she goes off narrative, so they want to shut her down. But the reality is we have common cause because she again says, rather than just go out and destroy a country, I'd like to stop and think about it first. I'd like to understand why we're going to go kill 100,000 people.
Which is wild to see that be a controversial take.
Isn't it?
I used to think that I was a member of a party who didn't like war at all. And here we are.
Turns out. Yeah, turns out.
I was wrong.
Well, when you think about it.
Or it shifted. I think we're in the midst of a monumental shift where priorities are realigning. I certainly wouldn't have ever thought myself to be as holistic or natural leaning as I am today. I would have called those ladies crunchy granola moms before, and I am literally a crunchy granola mom now. God likes to make me everything I've ever mocked. So I think priorities have changed along with our understanding of how things have changed without our knowledge in terms of production, food growth, where we're getting things from, our pharmaceutical companies, all of it. I think there's been a huge shift over the last, I would say, especially 4 years, thanks to our upcoming guest.
Mm-hmm.
But over 8 to 10 years, there's been a real shift or a furthering of awareness, let's say, that something's wrong here. Something's wrong.
Well, that's right. So when you think about the idea that challenging war is bad, okay, that clearly, we've got common cause. And then you start saying again, coming back to the question of could this all be just incompetence? Well, we saw once again this week a top aide to Andrew Cuomo and to Kathy Hochul, the governor, the current governor of New York, was just arrested for being a Chinese spy.
And two of Mayor Eric Adams' staff members had their electronics taken, their homes are being searched. Something is going on in New York.
Well, when you look at that and you go back and think about somebody like Dianne Feinstein, whose driver was arrested for being a Chinese spy, Swalwell,
Eric
whose girlfriend
Swalwell.
Is a Chinese spy,
yep.
You know, you
Feng
start
Feng.
Seeing a pattern. And the pattern is that these people who seem to not be representing the United States and the interests of our citizens are not
are representing actually not
the United States
us.
And our citizens.
Yeah.
They actually are, you know, somehow so intertwined with the other side, in many cases making money there, that they have abandoned the nation. And with that, we will now take this to this next discussion because it's an important one. It's one that's been brewing for a long time. And joining us right now is Dr. Peter McCullough. Now, many of you know who Dr. Peter McCullough is because you've been seeing interviews and been to maybe events, rallies and things since the COVID attack started. But just to give you a very brief introduction, he's an internist, a cardiologist, an epidemiologist, co-author of the book, The Courage to Face COVID-19, Preventing Hospitalization and Death While Battling the Biopharmaceutical Complex. Now, that's quite a long title, but there's a lot to get into there. So, Dr. McCullough, thank you. Welcome to the Conservative Voice on WWDB AM 860.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. You know, I tweeted this out to over a million people, so we should have a lot of people calling in. Hopefully, we'll have some great questions.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So what we're going to do, we're going to go for about a half hour, then we'll take a little break. We'll do another half hour. And then in that last half hour, if we haven't gotten to them before, if we get some good questions, we'll really try to focus then. So to your point, if people have questions, you can call 888-329-3306, and we will bring you into the conversation. So, you know, what an odd road it's been these last 4 years with everything we've seen, things that none of us could have really ever imagined. Tell us, maybe just briefly to start out, how did you get engaged in this path that you're on, which has obviously caused you tremendous turmoil in your professional life and so on? How did you get activated and start questioning this COVID thing?
Boy, just think about that issue you just raised about questions. So here, you know, America was told there's a pandemic. It's a virus taking people's lives. And, you know, we're coming up on 5 years. Our public health agencies, major health systems, hospitals, to this day, have not held a Q&A session with an open mic from the public about what's going on. I mean, that's a stunning revelation, stunning observation. How can we actually have a public health crisis, but the public health community answer no questions? I mean, I guess I'm one of the only ones who will ever take questions from an open mic. So I'm a practicing internist and cardiologist in Dallas, Texas. I've been in academic medicine my entire career, 4 decades, you know, highly published in my field, heart and kidney disease. I turned my attention to COVID-19. Now, clinically, in terms of how to treat the illness and manage the vaccine complications, I'm number one in the world in terms of publication, peer-reviewed publication, dedicated scholarship, and clinical practice to this issue. There have been 2 major protocols copyrighted in my name. So talk about taking responsibility. McCullough Protocol for the early treatment of COVID-19 to prevent hospitalizations and deaths. And then McCullough Protocol base spike protein detoxification, an approach of what someone should do if they have long COVID or have taken the vaccines or both, which is common. No one else has done that in the world. You think by this time, when I went on Tucker Carlson 2021, I said, Tucker, there's no Harvard protocol for COVID. There's no Mayo protocol. I mean, this was the opportunity of the century.
It was.
For, you know, the blue ribbon academic community to actually show some leadership in a medical crisis, and yet they were nowhere to be found.
And did that cause you to begin to question what was actually going on? Is that what, you know, allowed you to get into the fight yourself?
Well, early on, I was, you know, professor of medicine, major health system. I was on a task force. And I remember early on, the task force meetings, quite honestly, were frightening. We had never heard of this virus before. All of us were caught flat-footed. Virtually every single call was about personal protective equipment, isolation rooms, reverse ventilation, hand sanitizers, masks. And I started to think after a few weeks, wait a minute, these are all for to protect us, the healthcare workers. What about the patients? They're the ones getting sick. Are we going to have anything on the patient? Like, how do we treat the patients? How do we prevent hospitalizations and deaths? Nothing.
Wow.
Week after week. And we were several weeks into this, and I was liaising with colleagues in Detroit and Yale and elsewhere, Emory. And I said, listen, my health system has no plans on preventing hospitalization and death. None. They're going to wait for people to come in the hospital. It's obvious the hospital is too late, like it is for almost all pneumonias, respiratory conditions. We have to do something in the community. Looked around. No one was doing anything. The National Institutes of Health was essentially telling us it's unassailable. We had Anthony Fauci on TV and his surrogates saying it's unassailable. Since what illness is untreatable today in modern medicine? We always have something to take an edge. All we have to do is reduce the intensity and severity of symptoms, and then people can ease through this. And there was a report published in JAMA, just as a letter, that really interested me. And it was about paramedics that were going out, picking up people with acute COVID, taking them to hospitals in 2020, largely from senior homes, you know, senior citizens living in their own apartments. And the vast majority were not in extremis. You know, the respiratory status was okay. Mm-hmm. Blood pressure was okay. They didn't need to go on the ventilator, you know, according to the paramedic assessment. I said, wait a minute. You know what that is? That's panic.
Right.
So people were actually told to stay in isolation. They couldn't see their family members. Can you imagine a 75-year-old person who lives alone and, you know, diabetes and high blood pressure and heart disease and lung disease, and they're told, listen, there's no treatment. Just wait until you can't bear it anymore, and then push the panic button. And that's what Americans did. Our most vulnerable Americans did that. When they went to the hospital, then their family members could not see them. This was the first time in medical history. You know, we have all these respiratory conditions, tuberculosis, and all these. We always have family members see their loved ones in the hospital. Always. Yes. Suddenly, that wasn't allowed. And then quickly, these government protocols got assigned. We've never had government protocols become a standard of care in the United States, ever, for any condition. And when I saw these things happening, I said, wait a minute. Something is really wrong. I told Tucker Carlson when I said, listen, if I can't turn this around, nobody can, because I was the strongest person in the field. And largely, fortunately, early treatment did come in. We had U.S. Senate testimony, telemedicine services, and we essentially saved the country. Sadly, some people did die. And those who died exclusively is because they didn't receive any treatment.
It is interesting the way that happened, where suddenly we were testing everybody with a test that everyone knew didn't work. And yet people treated it as if the test was legitimate. And then they would get tested. They would go to the hospital for these protocols that didn't work.
Right.
And I remember that discussion about Harvard. I remember when you were on Tucker and that discussion about Harvard. So I went out to the websites and I started looking and saying, okay, well, what are they saying? And from Cleveland Clinic to Mayo to, you know, Harvard and all these other major systems, there was really nothing. It was shocking to me. And so what was replacing that? Exactly what you said. Everybody then turned and suddenly the whole nation is looking at one unelected bureaucrat as the person that holds the keys of knowledge and wisdom and power to decide what we should do, what we will do, and what you can't do.
Right.
I was
what's not permitted,
and if it is, and if you do what you're not supposed to do, we're coming for you, or you're just going to die. Of course, in the red number, the red things on CNN's web, So
do you remember the counter? I mean, honestly,
the death counter.
How many years did we live with a death counter on CNN and MSNBC, and I mean, even Fox News participated in that some point in time.
And if you looked at the underlying numbers, so where I ended up getting with this is I was looking at this going, I don't understand. How is it that all of these medical professionals and all of these fabulous institutions that we've all, you know, really had tremendous respect for, we've seen miracles performed in some of these hospitals
right.
where people that we were certain were going to die suddenly lived. And yet suddenly, all that's aside, they're all silent. None of them have the faintest idea what to do. It's one man. It's Anthony Fauci who will dictate every outcome. And now we have to surrender our Constitution, surrender our rights, surrender everything in order to survive this thing that has a mortality rate that's quite low. It was an astonishing situation. And I think many of us now, years later, I mean, it doesn't feel like it, but yeah, it's 5 years. A lot of us have kind of forgotten how intense that was and what a perversion of our national identity and our way of governing that was.
You know, the thing that struck me and still does today is how simultaneous and worldwide it was.
Yeah.
So, you know, Anthony Fauci in the United States, it was another public health official in another country in Europe and Canada and across. It was simultaneous and worldwide. The same theme, you know, all treatments for COVID-19 were prohibited. Patients were essentially, you know, scheduled to get progressively sicker, high-risk ones,
right.
come in the hospital, have their rights stripped away, and then sadly, virtually all the deaths occurred in the hospital. But, you know, the fact that it's worldwide, the first guidelines that came out that I recall was actually in Australia by what's called their TGA, the Therapeutic Goods Administration. And what it was is it basically was a list of prohibited drugs. You may not use this. You may not use that. You may not. And they just went through one by one by one. They actually put in the laws that a doctor could be imprisoned or federal fines if they attempted to use one of these drugs. So, and then what we saw in the United States is, you know, we estimate about 500 doctors carried the entire country through COVID. I mean, this is astonishing. We got a Wow. million doctors in the United States. We got a 500,000 nurse practitioners and PAs. And we estimate it's about 500 carried it. I mean, I'm the most published person in the field and the most academically qualified of anybody on that team of 500. And I was astonished how the rest of the community just basically evaporated. I mean, I didn't even get any emails. I was hoping I'd get a challenging email from someone at Harvard. I was just the named visiting professor there in two departments in 2019. Yeah, so they knew me well.
Right.
I published a chapter in the most well-known Harvard cardiology textbook, Bramwell's textbook of cardiology for over two decades. I was editor of two major journals. The whole country knew me well. I'd given grand rounds at the Mayo Clinic. I'd expect an email or a text saying, wow, we disagree with you. we think patients really should be denied treatment and come into the hospital. No, nothing. I couldn't get any engagement with these doctors. So, and then, you know, one by one, we saw these threats come in. And then actions taken against patients. You know how that was weaponized? Is that patients would actually get a lawful prescription. A doctor would attempt to treat a patient with this emerging community standard of care. And then the pharmacists would deny the treatment.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. If you were lucky enough to be able to find a doctor who would prescribe these medications for you, and you went to the pharmacy to get that prescription filled, depending on the kind of pharmacist you were dealing with, suddenly they had the right to refuse your service and they would not fill those prescriptions. So it was at every level, really. There was interference at every level.
But you know, it goes on today. Like I saw patients in the office yesterday with long COVID syndrome. And there is an emerging standard of care for long COVID syndrome. Patients are routinely denied these medicines for long COVID syndrome. So the patient said, listen, it's for my long COVID syndrome. Pharmacist said, nope, sorry, I can't dispense it. So it still goes on today. Anything related to COVID, and I want people to understand the comprehensiveness of this. In early 2020, the Federal Trade Commission created a new law. It's called the COVID misinformation law as it relates to products on the shelf. And essentially, they took down quickly company after company with federal lawsuits of any company that could have a product available over the counter that could help them. So we're talking nasal sprays and gargles, nutraceuticals. They were all, this is a stunning development. Wait a minute, that's early in 2020. I mean, people can't even try to use a nasal spray to help themselves. The companies were, you know, wanting to do research. They were filing protocols with the FDA that were being denied.
And it wasn't
they
as
had,
if...
already had preliminary data that...
It wasn't as if these things you're speaking of had some sort of negative impact, that they would somehow be detrimental.
No. Or you know, were dangerous drugs. They weren't dangerous drugs.
Yeah, they weren't saying if you take that nasal spray, possibly your nose will fall off. There was no downside, and yet it had to be prohibited.
And can we just jump on the fact that when I started hearing about coronaviruses in December 2019, I started researching. It's what I do when I hear something I don't understand. And the first article I found was a study from 2015 from the NIH, National Institute of Health, and it said that hydroxychloroquine or Plaquenil was not only an effective treatment, but it was an effective prophylaxis. And I had been on Plaquenil for years for an autoimmune disease, so I immediately was like, oh, well, I should be good then. It's not going to get me. And I, you know, I completely forgot about it. And then it's, you know, February 2020, and it's a completely different thing. And people would be panicked. And I'd say, oh, well, here, let me send you this 2015 study that should calm you down. There's nothing to freak out about. It's a cold. It might be a little bit more severe, but there's medicine available. It's health. I've been on it for years. It's healthy medicine. It's not bad for you. And suddenly, I mean, I was suspended on the internet. I was getting yelled at by people, and it was mind-blowing. The information was available, and suddenly we're not allowed to talk about that information anymore. Had you ever seen this before, especially in terms of medication that I would say are not terribly risky medications?
No, we always take the approach of, you know, first of all, do no harm. And listen, this was a fatal illness for some. If we could head this off at the pass. Do you know the Indian Medical Society, March of 2020, said every doctor start taking hydroxychloroquine, every nurse.
They handed out kits.
Take it once a week. Indian Medical Society. Yeah, Clive Palmer, a billionaire in Australia, bought enough hydroxychloroquine for the entire country.
I remember
to
that.
Help them out. The Australian authorities seized the supply and destroyed it.
It's incredible. So, all right. So here's the question, though. We've got, you know, a million doctors. We've got 500 PAs and nurses. How did they get everyone, nearly everyone? It was a small fraction of a percent that stood up and asked questions. How did they get everyone to comply immediately?
I think first off, it was an injection of fear. Originally, I was talking to my colleagues. They were afraid of getting the illness themselves. We were impressed from a report from the Milan area of Italy There's about 1,000 doctors in this report who died. A lot of them were older. But I think when that report came out, we said, oh, my Lord, we ourselves could be wiped out by this. I remember the discussions. And so immediately when there was an executive order that allowed telemedicine, doctors closed their clinics. Virtually every clinic was closed. I'm a cardiologist. Our catheterization laboratories were closed, bypass surgery programs. And so we literally sat in fear looking around like, you know, what's going to happen? Andrew Cuomo was giving these press briefings. Yep. You guys probably remember that.
I do.
And I remember watching this. And at one point in time, Cuomo, he said, listen, this is going to spread across the country. You think New York's bad? He named the other cities, Atlanta, Dallas. Yeah. I was like, oh, my Lord, this is going to hit us.
Yeah.
And I started studying this, and it wasn't spreading the way that he was describing. And so, you know, so by invitation in 2020, I was writing op-eds in The Hill. I was one of two doctors. It was myself and Scott Atlas. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a whole series of op-eds, and I challenged what Cuomo said. I said, it's not spreading this way. It's in these tight urban environments. It's not, you know, people outdoors in the Midwest. It doesn't seem to have the same punch power. People, you know, in elevators and in closed high-rise condos. Wuhan is a very vertical city, yeah. New York, these cities. And it wasn't spreading that way. And I said, I didn't see this. But, you know, in Dallas, where I am now, the public health authorities were so moved, they created an army hospital at the K. Bailey Hutchison Convention Center.
Right.
And they had 1,200 beds, ventilators, Army National Guard people staying attention, IV poles. And I published an op-ed. I said, they're not going to use a single bed. They're not going to use a single
How many
ventilator.
Beds did they
complete
use?
Complete waste of resources, because I was looking at my own hospital and I didn't see the cases. I mean, we were having some of these late presenting cases, but come on. And sure enough, I was right. So in this series of op-eds through 2020, I nailed it every single time. Now, I was focusing on the need for early treatment. And Scott Atlas, which I think was a mistake, his complete focus was on masking and lockdowns.
Yeah.
Which I think is a mistake. Masking and lockdowns are not treatment. Whether you're for them or against them, they're not going to help a single person. But treatment would. We should have had a complete focus on treatment. When you read Atlas's book, and you know, I know Scott well. He's a contemporary of mine from Stanford. Scott, in his book, according to all his meetings with Trump, he never discusses early treatment.
Wow.
And he met with him many, many times. Trump himself gets early treatment in April, and it never comes up again. Yet people, some people really did die with COVID in the United States. It was grossly exaggerated, the number of deaths, based on this testing and lack of adjudication. But still, this blindness to treatment. And so when the vaccine started coming along, it looked to me like, wait a minute, this is railroading the people into mass vaccination. So I published an op-ed in The Hill in August of 2020 titled The Great Gamble of the COVID-19 Vaccine Development Program.
Yep.
You're talking to the only public figure in the world who put this in writing in a major journal, read by the House, Senate, and White House. Not even Robert F. Kennedy saw this.
Wow.
I mean, think about this.
Yeah.
You're talking to the only one. So how could I see this coming and the entire world be blindsided? I think it was fear.
Yeah.
I think there was this heavy coordinated government overlay. In my book, we call it the biopharmaceutical complex. There was practicing for this gone on for decades. In Peter Bragan's book, COVID-19, The Global Predators, he outlines 36 pandemic preparedness events, including the PREP Act back in 2005, all the way through to, like, you know, 25 of them have written documents you can review. It's clear this was people were preparing. And then six are filmed. The Johns Hopkins 2017 SPARS pandemic, sponsored by Gates Foundation and Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, said there's going to be a coronavirus. It's going to come from China. There's going to be confusion over treatment, and we're going to railroad the population in mass vaccination. And we will ask the President of the United States to help us do this. That's in 2017 in writing. Hopkins actually takes that monograph, and they publish two peer-reviewed papers on it to memorialize it.
And there's videos of these meetings. They are on film. So this is a perfect time, because we are going to go into a break here in a couple minutes. And I think when we come back, we can move into the vaccine rollout and what we saw there and how that has brought us to today in 2024. I joked with Gary on the way in today that I remember looking at the number of lines on the vaccine cards they were handing out and saying, do you really think they're going to stop at 3? and we were called crazy conspiracy theorists. Crazy. And what booster are we on now? I don't even know how many we're at. I've lost count on the series at this point. But I did see this week, I know you, I think, put something out and others have pointed out that the Pfizer vaccine is being recommended for infants, 3 doses by the time they're 9 months right now. So I think that's a really great spot to pick back up after the commercial and carry into the calls.
I think it's
stunning.
We've got about 30 seconds left. We'll come back after the break and kick off again. Just to give us a quick update, I'm on the CDC website right now, and it says people who are up to date with their COVID-19 vaccine have a lower risk of severe illness.
What?
What a journey it's been from take the injection or die, take
a
the injection
risk.
And you won't get sick,
yeah.
Take the injection, you won't make anyone else sick. Now it's, maybe it'll help, right? So it is a hard thing to accept that we as a nation, we as a world, let this happen. Thanks so much for joining us here, Dr. McCullough. We're going to come right back in a few minutes after the break and kick off once again with WWDB AM 860, The Conservative Voice. Thank you.